then we go straight to the Q&A. And there's a whole, book of them. Okay, this first one, more practical one. If someone stays at the monastery for only a month or two, do they have to have their hair shaved off? That's right. Actually, we're pretty lax here. We don't have a clear and fast rule. In Thailand, and more than 3 days, you have to shave up not only your hair, you have to shave up your eyebrow as well. So here I think, no, not necessarily, unless you have intending to become a monk or nun. But if you're staying as a guest, just to practice, you know, to deepen your meditation, you know, you can keep on, you know, keep your hair, definitely. But it's a nice nice reflection. See how much we're attached to our hair. See whether it comes off or not. But it also had a story when I was in training in Thailand, and that's the practice, you know, any more than 3 days, you have to shave up your hair and eyebrow. And we had this this guy who came, he's lived there before and kind of went back to America and came back again. So he's been there before, so he kind of, he thinks, oh, I know the routine. So he goes and asks the abbot, I think Jai Charles, Ajahn, I've got to go back to work. And I can't be bald, it looks funny, especially my eyebrow. So he says, you know, can I keep my hair and eyebrow? I want to stay here a week. So I want the exemption to keep my eyebrow at least. Yeah, I can do it with the bald head, no problem, because it's, you know, quite trendy in the US to have bald head. But eyebrow just looks funny. so he got Ajahn Jai Charles, yeah, you can keep your eyebrow. So he goes to the monk. He tells him, I've got this special permission from, you know, the abbot. So I can keep my eyebrow. So you can shave my head, but don't touch my eyebrow. Keep it. And the monk says, yeah, of course you can keep your eyebrow. Just stick your hand out. But, okay, next question. Teaching. Buddha said, bad thoughts not arise, don't let it arise. Good thought not arise, encourage it arise. We learn words easy but not in practice. How can we develop about this? Thanks, Bhante. With anything, it's just with training, slowly, with the mind. First we recognize that, you know, unwholesome thoughts bring suffering for ourselves and the people around us. So when we see that, you know, just kind of red light to go up. Thoughts of anger, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming, you know, other people. Or also thoughts of greed. That's more, like I was saying the other day, it's more subtle. Anger, ill will is actually easier to spot and easier to let go of. But thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of having things, being things, that's a bit trickier. We have to notice that as well and try to let go of those. But in this way, practice of mindfulness helps. That if, you know, we just have to be mindful of these, you know, to see whether these thoughts arise in the mind, whether they're wholesome or unwholesome. Anything, like I say, brings harm to ourselves or others, it's unwholesome, and try to let them go as best as we can, or to recognize that they're unhelpful. And then slowly, once you have stronger mindfulness, and you see clearly that they're going to bring suffering to yourself and other people, the mind automatically let that go. But it is the case that it's, you know, it's constant training, vigilance, and that's why this practice of mindfulness, of knowing where you are, you know, this practice of seeing clearly into your own mind, it's very important. Because for most of us, our mindfulness is not as sharp. We walk through life almost half in a daze. And that's why the word for Buddha is the awakened one. He's the only true one awake. Most of us, as if we walk through life, you know, in a daze, because our mindfulness is not that clear. And that's why kind of practice of, you know, of meditation helps that. It declutters the mind. We have so many things spinning in our head. So we can actually see clearly when things arise, whether they arise for our welfare or happiness, or arise for our stress and suffering. Yeah. For anything, yes. But most things, it's easy to say, easy to read, but hard to do. But that's what the practice is. Constant chipping away. four wholesome qualities. Okay. Is that clear? Questions or comments? Please tell us about enlightenment, how it feels, and how and when it happens, etc. Thank you. I think enlightenment, this is what it says in the sutta, it's when you're enlightened, you know you're enlightened. So that's the nice thing. It's not like you stumble on it and then you're like, oh, am I enlightened or not enlightened? No, it's very clear. They're specific. And that's one of the ways that you can test a monk. Or that's how we test, the monks can test each other. When you go to the teacher and say, oh, I think, you know, I've cracked it. He will say, when did that happen? It's a very specific time, it's a very powerful breakthrough, so you would remember very clearly. It's like a drama in your mind, but a positive drama where you can remember. And if, you know, you're walking meditation and things just start to, you know, explode or crash, you know, certain, we have delusions about the self, you know, in ourselves. Something, a breakthrough somehow. And it's very, very clear. And it's also very, very blissful. You know, in many stories, the Buddha said apparently after his enlightenment, he was sitting in bliss, uninterrupted bliss, for 7 days. So happy he didn't need to move. And although some of the stories obviously are embellished, exaggerated, but that one I can understand. Because when the mind is happy, you don't need to move. And that's why people feel in meditation for many, many hours if things are going well. And it's the same. If you, you know, just after your enlightenment, obviously you let go of so much. So the only thing that's left is this, you know, perfect happiness. So that's one of the characteristics of enlightenment. Is you know exactly when it happened very clearly. And I was saying yesterday, it's true regarding, you know, it's a feel. And in terms of, you know, just kind of we can project or extrapolate. Not having any anger, enlightened person, like I was saying, it doesn't arise. Bad thoughts doesn't arise in the mind. It's not an act of suppression, not an act of repression, but it just doesn't arise. And also thoughts of greed or lust doesn't arise. Whatever is happening, whatever you have in the present moment, you're perfectly content with that. There's no thoughts of moving to the past, moving to the future. Of wanting things, once you get things, or once you get rid of things. So it's utterly, perfectly content. And like I said, and that's where you can see the practice is leading us towards that. And also in terms of harmlessness. And there's 8 things that a enlightened person can do. And one of it is to take a life of another living being. Even to step on an ant intentionally to kill that. An arahant, a perfectly enlightened person, will not do that. To take another life for whatever reason, they won't be able to do that. And that's an interesting thing. Just kind of reflect the level of harmlessness in their mind. And not saying, oh, I'm a human person, you know, I'm bigger or better or whatever. You're just a little ant. I can do away with you. No, they can recognize that each living being, there's a consciousness, there's a desire to live. And so there's also a sense of self. I'm better. Obviously, we can recognize that that's not good, so that's something to let go of. But I'm worse. Sometimes we think, it's better to be humble, to think I'm worse, and it must be a good thing to develop. But also, that's what the Buddha said, that's also undesirable. I'm better, it's not good, it's something that you let go. I'm worse. I'm the worst one in this room, I just can't meditate. Also, it doesn't come up into the mind of an enlightened person. But the third one, one interesting one. I'm equal. Also, doesn't arise in the mind. Any kind of comparison of a sense of self doesn't arise in the mind of an enlightened person. So it's good reflection. Because you think about it, although it looks like, you know, we all come together and we have a mind and a body and we're meditating and we learn how to meditate. And you think, oh yeah, I've been doing this for 5 years, you know, she's been doing this for 10 years or whatever, I should be better than her or whatever. But the conditions that made into our mind and body, there's the billions and billions of different conditions So how can we compare? Comparing one person to another, it's like comparing a bicycle and an orange. There's no basis, really, of comparison. Because we are the way we are because of the billions and billions of conditions that come to make us a person of how we are. And with another being, they may look the same, but you know, it's from the same background. They have two arms, two legs, two eyes. It looks similar, but actually, in reality, it's not. It's very, very different. And that's why it's kind of unhelpful to any kind of comparison. Also, it's from a delusion of a self, that there's something inside doing this, some core to a being. So any comparison is interesting. It's also out the window. When an enlightened being doesn't occur, I'm better, worse, or equal. Three conceits that the Buddha says, all from a delusion of a self, obviously. So it's an interesting kind of a reflection. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments? Yes?
I'd like to know about always you can encourage a plant to grow and love a plant and certainly admire a tree and see the individuality in trees and stuff. I've always had a bit of difficulties where, you know, vegetarianism and, you know, that's where the line is drawn. It's like, it's okay to eat a plant, but it's not okay to eat an animal.
That's right. I think it's tricky. I mean, things grow, but also I think even for Buddhists, we believe that the plant doesn't have like a one, they call it a one sense animal. It can roughly feel things, but it cannot move or react, really. So from Buddhism, we don't see the plant in the same level of consciousness as an animal. The animal clearly feels happiness and suffering, pain, you can see very clearly. But the plant, I mean, in terms of our kind of dichotomy of into living or non-living, animal or plant. Yes, animal is clearly conscious, whereas the plant, you know, we don't think it's so conscious. And the encouraging of the plants. Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think more research is going into that. Is apparently some plants do feel. You know, there's a sense of, but I'm not sure how. Whether that would bear out if you do more research, or whether it's responding to something else, some other stimuli. Yeah. So that, I'm not sure. But it's true. But for us, I think vegetarian is definitely very, clear. That's not blamable. You're not taking the life of a living being. Otherwise, yeah, it would be very difficult to eat anything. Yeah. It's considered living as well. Is that clear? Yeah, sorry, Kat? Music? Chanting?
Chanting.
Oh, yeah, 10 things. I think 8 things. I think it's 8 things. One, if you take anything that's not given, so they're very clear in the moral precepts. This is interesting to know. Also, no, he does not obviously kill any living beings, take anything that's not given, store up food like a householder. He doesn't have any desire to store up food, not thinking about tomorrow. And also, he does not can't have any sexual intercourse. There's just no desire there. I think Brown's little joke was that he's potently impotent. And the other one is utter a lie, tell a conscious lie. And the sixth one is if he does something wrong, he confesses it right away. He's very open. If he makes a mistake or he does something wrong, he will tell another person right away. That's seven. Yeah, it doesn't break into the five precepts. It keeps it very pure. So no consumption of liquor. And that's the three things. Maybe he never acts out of greed, hatred, or delusion, because obviously he's done away with all that. No, he doesn't get born again. He's one of the people that don't get born again. But there's a technical debate on whether he goes to a special realm where other arahants go. I tend to think not, but some people are different. But that, again, it's one of those things that yeah, you get there and you find out for yourself. Yes, sorry. Tomorrow? Excuse me? I'm sorry. Good question. That's right. I the only enlightened beings I met are the one in Thailand. I believe it to be enlightened. So yeah, my last year I met a couple. So I thought are very happy looking people. And I will try to invite them here in March or April. But also it's a touchy thing because you're not supposed to ask him outright. So usually you get, you know, very enthusiastic. Oh, Acharya, is that true you're enlightened? You usually say, well, it's not, you know, it's not something I talk about, but you practice the way I do. You practice in a, you know, the way the Buddha recommended, and then you can also, you know, you find it for yourself. You see? Yes. Excuse me? No, they speak in Thai, but there is usually a translator. There was one English monk who was highly attained, but he died last year. He was living in Thailand, and that was great because you could actually have a conversation with him, and that was very nice. He was in Thailand for 40 something years, and that was certainly one of the nice things. He didn't have to go through a translator and all that stuff. Yeah. And what else? Yeah. Okay. Yes, sorry, go ahead. I can tomato. See, that's the thing. I only know from the reputation for the monks I live with. Lumpur Tomato, I think, yes, you know, he definitely has a reputation of being an attained monk. I only haven't spoke to Lumpur regarding Lumpur because I haven't lived with Lumpur, so I wouldn't know. But his reputation is, yeah, it's a highly attained monk. Certainly very happy to be around. When I was around him, he was very happy, kind of a demeanor, very easy to be around. Excuse me? Yes, yes. I don't think he travels all that much, or he gets plenty of invitation, but he's limiting his travel because he is getting very, very old. I did meet him in Thailand last month, and that's very nice. He seems very, very happy.
Sorry if you've
already said that. No. Yeah, it's one of the things that monks are not allowed to tell lay people their attainment. Not even whether they get jhanas or deep meditation, because there's very specific rules around that. That way, you know, it's supposed to be more of a private thing between him and his teacher. And the other thing is you can tell another monk of your attainment. And usually with these things is the monk would say to his best friend, and then his best friend would kind of leak the word, or he would tell it to his teacher, and his teacher would say that. So basically, you know from reputation. And to know who is enlightened or not enlightened, it's mainly also a matter of faith. Because monks can be, you know, very, like I say, they're good, getting good meditation. All their problems can be quite suppressed. And you won't know truly until you live with them for many years. And the reason I have faith in these monks, that they are, you know, enlightened, is that they have monks and Western monks who live with them for 10, 15 years. And they said, you know, yeah, I haven't seen him, you know, get mad or anxious over, you know, most things. And obviously, you know, you also kind of take things with a grain of salt, because if you live with a master, of course, there's a tendency to think the best of your teacher. I say, of course my master is enlightened, come on, I'm, you know. Because he's also, he's my master, right? It's a sense of self. So, but then you ask a few monks, and then everybody's experience when they go and stay with him is the same. It's like, well, yeah, you know, I may not like the way he teaches, I may not like it, you know, the monastery, how it's set up, but yeah, I haven't seen him do or say anything that you know, would come close to, you know, having, it appears to be like aversion or anger. But yeah, but that's also, it's a lot of things, it's by faith. And like I said, I would bring these, and you know, don't accept my word. You come see for yourself. you know how they act, and that's a nice thing. We have an image of what they're like, you know, something for some people think. Because you're enlightened, you've got no emotional response, you're kind of very serious all the time. But no, they're very easygoing, and they definitely have preferences and regarding certain things. It's not like, you know, you put everything in front of their face and they eat everything. Because, oh, no preference, no liking, dislike. No, if they're growing up in Thailand, then they have certain preference for Thai food, because that's what they're used to. So it's not like, you know, they're completely, you know, indifferent. There's certainly a personality behind that. And then you can meet different attaining monks, and you get a feel. That's what I found for myself that was inspiring. Because sometimes you have a teacher and he's very different from you. You're like, oh, I'm not like this. How can I, you know, train the path? Maybe I don't know how to take it. We're very different personality or whatever. You know, Rajan Brahma, I can't tell jokes. Rajan Brahma isn't a mystery, you know, personality. But then you see other monks and they're, you know, they have different varieties. And you realize that, you know, there's many different paths towards, you know, liberation. And that you don't have to fit a certain mold. And that's why I guess it's also very useful to meet also nuns who are enlightened. Because you can see, okay, yeah, it's just not a male thing. It's also, you know, it's equal to anybody. You have a mind and a body. You can't practice. And that's why I think it's just quite useful just to meet them. And also just to have this kind of interested, you know, inquiry. You don't know for sure, but you see. See how they act. You ask them different questions and see how they respond. Is it out of compassion, out of kindness, or is it a sense of self behind that? Yeah, this is interesting. But hopefully we'll get some. Yes, Josie?
Did you say, if you see a Buddha on the road, running him over, what does it mean?
If you see the Buddha on what?
If you see a Buddha on the road, run him over, what does it mean?
Yeah, it's a Zen thing. It's supposed to kind of shock you to make sure, you know, you see a Buddha, kill them, stab them, stab them. It's just to wake you up. Ah, why do we do that? The main thing is that the point of that kind of koan, puzzle, paradox, is that way we're not looking for the Buddha outside of us. Each and every one of us is, you know, the Buddha inside. And that's what we should be looking for. We shouldn't be looking for the perfect teacher to an extent out there, that everything that, you know, meets our expectations. And that's the interesting thing, when you meet these things, they don't meet all your expectations. Sometimes they can be quite frustrating to live with them, I can mean. Because they're like, wow, it looks like you have defilements, Ajahn. But you don't know. But they certainly push your button as well. It's not always kind of unbounded metta. They do have unbounded metta towards you. But they also want you to, you know, work on your defilements. So they push your buttons a lot. And Ajahn Chah was famous. He trained monks like Tormund, which is a Thai word, which means torture. You know, you don't like to wake up early in the morning, it'll make you, you know, wake up at 2 o'clock morning chanting every day. Or go without sleep. Just to push you to see, you know, what you think you can endure. And a lot of time we're much more kind of adaptable than we think we are. But it's also very challenging because they do push you. And because you have faith, you do what your teacher tells you to do. But it's not always easy. And that's the reason I think, going back to the cone of, you see the Buddha, you have run him over, because that way you're not looking for the perfect teacher outside, but you're trying to develop those qualities inside yourself. Yeah. And I think Ajahn Bosomelio, the story about it, I think I read one in the book, that he was one of the first Western monks to live with Ajahn Chah, and in his monastery for many, many years. And the Bosomelio is a very serious American. He's got to do everything right. He's got to do everything correctly. He's there for enlightenment only. He's not messing around. So in Thailand, he's got many hours of chores. Sleeping, you know, 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon. In the morning, a couple more hours of sweeping. And so he got fed up and went to Ajahn Chah. I'm here for enlightenment. I'm not here to teach the Sufi monastery. What's the problem? You do too much chanting, too much sleeping. It's a waste of time. So, and then he says, you know, and furthermore, you don't look so enlightened, you know, Ajahn. I've seen you, you know, have preferences of food. You like this, you like that. What's wrong with you? You don't look very enlightened to me. So Ajahn Chah just laughs and says, yes, yes, yes. If I'm the perfect, you know, monk that you think, if I'm the Buddha that you have you in your mind, then you wouldn't look for the Buddha inside yourself. So go back and look for the Buddha inside yourself. Stop looking at me. So that's Ajahn Chah's kind of response to that. Yeah, and that's the thing. Obviously, it's nice to have a teacher, but ultimately, they, even the great teachers, great arhats who can read your mind, great arhats who finish the work, cannot still do the work for you. It's up to each and every one of us to kind of tread our own path, to let go of our own attachment, you know, gradually, step by step. And the same with the Buddha. He even said, you know, I'm only the person who walks the path and shows you the path. Each and every one of you have to walk that path by yourself and alone. And that's kind of the crux of the practice. That's the reason why, yeah, it's nice to be with an inspiring teacher. But sometimes, and I've seen it, you know, monks, you know, I was, you know, just came back from the monasteries, you know, these few highly attained monks. And they've got a group of really, you know, devoted disciples around them. But you can see there's a bit of a guru worshiping. It's like, yeah, this is my Ajahn, man. He's the man. And they just want to hang around him. Just hang out with him all day long. They never meditate. They just kind of sit down with Ajahn, just, you know, kind of talk. Just kind of, you know, just chit chat all day long. Just run around Ajahn, just do things with him, massage him, wash his robe, wash his shoes, whatever. Just little things. Just because they like him. And he's obviously very pleasant to be around. But they can see that they get lost in this kind of worship. Have a lot of faith, but they just never end up doing anything else. They spend all their waking moments just to hang out with that guy. And you can see that, yeah, it's nice, but at the end of the day, you still have to go back to your hut and wash your breath, basically. And sometimes that is the kind of the drawback of living with a great teacher. You lose the status of your own breath. Okay. Questions or comments? Next, do you think it is okay to use the meditation focus if one is having difficulty getting to sleep, i.e. in order to calm the mind and then drift off to sleep? Yeah, I find it really useful. If you do have a problem falling asleep, just, you know, do a body sweep, or just watch your breath, you know, do a few breaths slowly, and then the mind will relax and kind of drift into sleep naturally, especially lying down. Just breathe and try to relax your body, you know, shoulders and different tense areas you might have. And slowly you find that you not only fall to sleep faster, but your sleep is deeper. You finally wake up the next morning, yeah, it's quite refreshing. So yeah, it's an easy thing to do. One is just focus on it. If you're having a problem sleeping, just lie there and just kind of try to watch your breath. Relax your body in what way? So it's a very valid way to fall asleep if you're having a problem. Questions or comments? Okay, moving along. Got the whole book here. Okay. Thank you for your excellent point about the fact that even Buddhists have to have some degree of faith that Buddha reached enlightenment. Having studied some of the Christian variants, I know that some people in all traditions expect others to rigidly conform to certain beliefs and practices. On the other hand, there have been great thinkers and even some proclaimed saints. For example, Saint John of the Cross, a Christian mystic, meditator, who are well known to have had grave doubts about what they were told to believe. Nevertheless, the hierarchies have seen these dark nights of the soul as possible steps or an ongoing spiritual journey. Perhaps they also occur in Buddhism. Can you comment on any Buddhists who you know have also had grave doubts yet are still recognized as people worthy of respect and recognition, maybe bodhisattvas? Good question. I think, but from a Buddhist perspective, doubt is one of the obstacles. So I don't know whether you're pointing to doubts about, there's obviously you can doubt many things. So one is doubt that the Buddha was enlightened. Two, you can also doubt whether, if you don't have doubts about the Buddha's enlightenment, you can have doubts that maybe the teaching he's left behind is corrupted somehow because it's gone through many years of editing and writing down and memorization that could be corrupted, and what we have may not be in effect. The true teaching of the Buddha. You can also have doubt, obviously, in the enlightenment of different monks and nuns. But then, you know, doubt, from a Buddhist perspective, is seen as something that is an obstacle, because if you have doubt, then you're not going to really put forth the practice. And also, it leads to the wavering of the mind. And that's why one of the spiritual qualities of the five spiritual qualities, you're familiar with, one of them, the first one, and it's sequential, it's faith. You have faith that, you know, and you don't have to have complete faith, but you have to have faith that in the triple gem. That one, the Buddha is enlightened, two, that he left the teaching that's still good enough for you to practice and become enlightened. And three, that yes, you still can become enlightened based on your own efforts. So that's the three spheres of where faith is. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it should be open-minded enough to say that, you know, these things still work, I can still practice, and I have the requisites to progress along the path. I have a body, I have a mind, two arms. You know, those monks have two arms, I've got two arms. They've got two eyes, I've got two eyes. Yeah, I can also do the same thing they're doing. And you have to have that much faith if you start on the path. Is that what you're getting at, or comments? Yeah.
I think you are talking that the Western tradition is based on doubt.
Yeah.
Like the whole Enlightenment period, everything is based on doubt. And if you doubt it and doubt it, and then you test it and test it, and then it becomes true or not.
Right.
And I suddenly saw no conflict between faith and doubt. Because on the Dharma, you try it and try it and try it and try it until it becomes truth, so in a way.
Yeah, I think obviously there's testing. Okay, there's a healthy skepticism. Obviously, just to, you know, whatever I say, whatever any monk or nun say or any teacher say, you say, okay, that's interesting, but we'll see. So you do have to test it out, and then once you test it out, that's where faith grows, and that's why I see that the monks and the nuns and meditators have lots of doubts. It's because they haven't realized in the fruits of the practice. Once you sit down and your mind becomes calm, even for a minute or two, then you know for sure meditation works. You don't know it works perfectly, but you know, okay, this piece is something real, something I know for myself. I don't have to read in the book, you know, to get a clear description. I know, okay, that's what peace is like. So you do settle some doubts, and doubts, and most teachers will tell you, doubts will only be overcome through practice. Unless you know it for yourself, and then of course you're like, you know, is that true? Yeah, maybe it's true for him or for her, but I'm different. But once you taste the fruit, then you know for sure that doubt ends, because you've seen it. It's like, you know, if you've never tasted a mango, you're like, yeah. You've written lots of books about it, it tastes like this, mango trees look like that, you know, 200 types of mangoes, it blooms in this, in a way, flowers look like this. But you never taste the mango, you won't really know what it's like. And once you taste the mango, you don't have to cook again, because you know that's what it tastes like. So I think that's where doubt and kind of practice comes into play. That once you start realizing some of the fruits of the practice of meditation, or just being kind and being calm and not making, you know, trouble for yourself and others, you see, oh, okay, that works. You know, I didn't react out of anger. I checked myself. Yeah, so that's where, but like I said, the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, is always recommended to, you know, come investigate for yourself. Come see for yourself. And always kind of, you know, not to take everything on 100% on faith. No. Yeah, does that make sense? Okay. Questions or comments? The five spiritual qualities? It started with sadda, faith, and then with faith, and you can see, and this is true across the board, faith comes energy. With faith, you can move mountains. That's no saying, it's true, I've seen. You know, with faith, you've seen those people who came with us, you can move a big water tank up the hill. That's at the beginning. So it's, you know, you can, and energy arises. So faith is sequential. With faith comes, it's a condition for energy. When you have faith in something, you will put forth the effort necessary to do what needs to be done. when these start with faith. That's why faith is a precious thing. And sometimes in the modern world, it's a precious commodity. We're taught and conditioned not to believe in too many things, not to have too much faith. And sometimes it destroys your own spiritual journey because we won't get started because we don't have faith in anything. So we don't want to bother with anything. With faith comes energy. With energy comes mindfulness. When you have a bright, energetic mind, you're naturally mindful. You don't have to strive, you don't have to force your mind, you're just there. You're bright, you're clear, you know what's happening. It comes from an energetic mind. And when you have strong mindfulness, the mind becomes still easily. So samadhi, stillness, comes as a result of strong mindfulness. And that's why you hear meditation teachers harp on and on about mindfulness. If you want concentration, you have to have mindfulness. You have to know what's happening each and every moment of the day. You kind of harness it, you kind of work on it, train it in a way that you know whatever's happening, you know, you're right there. So stillness is a result from mindfulness. And then after you have stillness, wisdom comes. So it's sequential. It's automatic. So you're having a problem with your meditation, don't clench your fist, don't clench your teeth and grind away and to focus on the breath. But go back to the link of cause and condition. Go back to faith. Like I was saying earlier, faith in first we didn't enlighten, we knew what he was talking about, and so you, many of us have faith in the person, the teaching, and we're like, now, lots of things happening. I've got some deficient. I'm a strange gene in myself that I can't meditate. Whatever thing we give ourselves problems with. Once you have that faith, to a certain extent, then the energy will rise naturally. Comes up, that you can want to work to train your mind, you want to continue on this path, no matter how long it takes, as long as you're heading in the right direction, energy is always there. Even when you're tired, I'm really tired right now. Sit for a minute or two and see what happens. And that's where you see they have interesting results. When you're really tired, really prepared, you're like, you know what? Out of gratitude for the Buddha, gratitude for my teacher, I'm just going to sit and watch this tiredness for a little bit. And you'll be surprised. Sometimes the mind just becomes very, very still. You think, oh, I don't have anything left. What's going on here? And that's where faith is important. Use your percent. That's all you needed, was the extra few percent. To deep, push your stamina, your energy slightly further, and the mind opens up naturally. Yeah, so that's the spiritual qualities. I always try to work on that. Where am I lacking today? There's many different ways to dissect your practice and your mind. The five spiritual qualities, one the way. You can see that people have lots of faith, they can put up a lot of problems. And then I've seen that in living in the monastery. Some monks come and they look like they're natural. Smart, young, energetic, with that great meditation. And things are going well for them for a short time. They do everything right. They're the perfect monk. They wear the robe just right. Exactly the right role. They're evenly around. Great voice for chanting. Great memory. They remember everything you've told them. All the chant they learn within 3 weeks. Everything goes great for them. But then, sometimes they get sick. Or sometimes something comes up and they disrobe right away. Because they don't have this faith. Faith was very shallow. And we have the other monks, lots and lots of problems. Can't do anything right. Bad student, nobody wants them, that's why they chuck him into the monastery. That's what you do in Thailand. Can't do anything right, off you go to the monastery. Do some sweeping. And they're sick, constantly sick. But they had this faith that they said, I'm just going to put up with it. I'm not going to ask for too much. I'm going to survive another day. And got lots of problems, lots of fears, anxiety coming up, whatever. But they had this kind of wellspring of faith. just put up this one extra day. I'm just having a terrible day, but you know what? Tomorrow's going to be better. I know tomorrow's going to be a better day. Survive, and then, you know, 10 years later, the ceiling erupts. And all the star performers are all kind of married with kids. That's not to say it's a bad thing, but from a monastic point of view. Okay. Next question. Excuse me? No, there's faith, tada, virious energy, and then you have sati, mindfulness, samadhi, stillness, and tanya, wisdom. Yeah. Yeah, sure. How can we stop thinking? Great question. Yeah, the problem is there's a we in there. The thinking stops by itself, as long as we don't identify with the thought. No, and it's also the trick is not, you're not going to stop anything. Because there's a you in there trying to do the work. You know, the famous quote in one of the Buddhist texts is that the path to Nirvana is there, but no traveler is seen. So, you know, our path gets bigger and bigger. It's clear and smooth even. As long as we remove our sense of self, as long as we remove the sense of traveler, I am going, I'm doing this, I'm pursuing this path. As long as we kind of fade into the background. And the more the traveler fades, the clearer the path becomes. The more solid the traveler is, the smaller the path becomes. And to see that if you have a large sense of self and you need to do things, then life becomes very complicated, very sticky. You can't flow through life because the sense of self that gets in the way. I don't want to do this. I want, this is my views and opinions. If people don't agree with things, I get upset. But if you don't have a large sense of self, you say, okay, this is my opinion, but yeah, if you don't take it, it's also okay. But for most, it's very difficult, obviously. Even in the monastery. Ajahn, you do this. No. Oh, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to go somewhere else. And that comes to everybody, everything, everybody. So just to acknowledge that, though. That is, it's the practice, also the sense of meditation as well. The more of a sense of self we have, the harder it is to meditate. The more we think, the more we talk, the more we analyze, all that stems from a sense of self somewhere in there. And that's what we have to watch for. If it's not easy for you to let go of your thoughts, then it points that we are very attached to our thoughts and our thinking mind. And also in our culture, Western culture, we celebrate that. A person is clever when he thinks fast on his feet and he's quick and he can talk a lot and he can analyze. But that person is very hard to meditate. It's the same, this highly attained monk, English monk, and he said the same. He was living in Thailand for 40 years, and he said that, in the early days, you have these Thai kids, very simple kids, village kids, and they come in, they're just, tending buffaloes or whatever, but they don't, very simple. But they have really good meditation, because you tell them, sit still, watch your breath, and that's what they do. Now you have all these clever kids from Bangkok coming in, and they know all sorts of stuff. The computer, speak English and all that stuff. And you tell them to watch their breath and they can't do it. They're like, why? How do I watch my breath? Do it this way, should I do that? Where do I rush in the body? How is it going to work? And it's endless questioning. Because the mind, that's what happens. When you train the mind to kind of become diversified, that's what thinking is. It goes in different channels. It doesn't become still. So that's a trade-off in the society we live. It gets very complicated. Obviously, people are getting clever, by the different generations. But the cost of that is that we're not very peaceful people. We don't know how to be content. We always want to improve things, which is a nice way of looking at the fault-finding mind. To improve things, I'm going to improve things. So if you have a mind that says it's good enough, then you don't have to improve anything. You can sit still and enjoy things instead of constantly improving things. But, having known that, and having known kind of meditation, we can also use our mind, analytical mind, when there's a purpose. by the outside of work, when we're trying to meditate, we can also let go of that side of us. Okay, I'm meditating, I don't have to talk, I don't have to think, I don't have to do anything, I just have to be here. And slowly, through reconditioning, we can allow things to fade away. Well, that takes training, it takes patience. And there is no shortcut to stop the thinking mind, other than just patience, enduring it, and seeing that it's not you. You're not there doing the thinking, just thoughts appear because, you know, it's conditioned that way. Through our education, through, you know, the reading that we do, through the internet, that we're just conditioned to think a lot. And then we just have to recondition our mind not to think so much. Slowly, just paying attention, doing one thing at a time. Walking, just stay with the body. Zoom ahead to your destination, what you do when you get to the shop, what things you're going to buy, where you're going to park, you know, what lunch you're going to make. Just, yeah, just walking, just doing one thing. Yeah. So that's kind of a rough guide to work with the thinking mind. That's the thing, not to think that you're going to stop it, but you're going to work with it. You're going to relate to it in a positive way. That there are places for thinking. You know, doing things at your job, to analyze things, to figure things out, to order things, obviously to manage a retreat, plenty of thinking you have to do. But also know there's time and place that, yeah, okay, I'm sitting on my cushion, I don't need to think about what's going to happen tomorrow. Don't need to think about what happened earlier. Be here. Does that make sense? Questions or comments? My mind is starting to be at peace, and it's time to go home. And it's starting a 10-day retreat. I know a longer stay would be of great benefit. Thank you. Yes, good question. Well, first I think it's something that's definitely on the card, but like I said, we don't know whether you know we are, you know, kind of, it's a new monastery, a new scene, so we're trying to develop the level of volunteers and support. And you know, if the 10-day retreat would be more of a reality, if we have more volunteers, basically, that comes down to that. And so people interested in 10-day retreat, you can see Jillian, sign up for the volunteer sheet tomorrow, hand that around. But also, outside of organized retreats, you can come to the monastery anytime when I'm here to do your own 10-day retreat as well. Yes, and the monastery is open. Yes? Yes, the range retreat is that we experienced with that last year or this year. People can stay a minimum of a month or longer. Yes, you definitely can come during the range retreat where there's very little work. Mostly kind of chores and some slight cooking. But you have a lot of time in the afternoon to pursue your practice of meditation. And the watch is really, really beautiful in the winter. Very it's nice and cool in the morning, and yes, and very, very beautiful afternoon. But in the morning, it's on the cool side. Yes, but it's very still. Yes. But definitely something that people are on the card, something that you can participate in. Questions or comments? And it's true, a lot of times it's just staying in a place, allowing the mind just to slow down naturally without having to push it. And it's true, if you're staying, it's only 5 days, it's kind of just or whatever. But if you're staying a month, you're like, yeah, I've got lots of time. You know, take it easy, ease yourself into the retreat. And then because not much is happening in the monastery, the mind just slows down naturally. And you can find that meditation is more of an organic process. That just you just allowing things to calm down. You know, trying to hold it or control it or manage it. And you see that it's very, very natural. Yeah, it's less to do with you than the conditions that you put around it. Questions or comments? Yes, they stay home. No, but also it's very difficult if you come with the family and the kids. But I think we have open days that kids are welcome. But also during the day, basically you can bring your kids to the monastery for a day visit any day. You can stay, come early, have the meal with us, and then stay for a few hours afterwards. No problem. When we practice meditation, if we still thinking to achieve enlightenment, so we're creating another desire. Is that right, Bhante? It's true that if you want to get enlightened, you are putting obstacles. And something in meditation we call the walls of wanting. When you want something, you put up a wall between wanting jhanas, wanting the mind to stop thinking. You add another. Not only you're thinking, now you're thinking about not thinking. So that doesn't help. So that's the thing. The thing is, it's just to make peace. What when Mahasan Tutu was saying before, whatever's happening, just to make peace, just to be with that. And that's how things come to a still. It's kind of an indirect way of stilling the mind. It's just to embrace it, whatever it is. And actually that thing has become more manageable, become better, nicer, stiller, just through embracing being with it. And but having said that, you have to have some desire, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Unless you have a desire to train your mind to be somewhere else, you wouldn't be at a retreat over the new year. So there's a desire there. But just to know that where desire is helpful is just to spur you beyond the search for truth, beyond the search for stillness, beyond the search for for liberation. But once you get to the meditation retreat, that's where you have to leave all your desires and your wanting at the gate out there. Leave it there. Once you're here just to be here, no desire, don't want anything, I just want to be here. Be with whatever is arising in my mind and body. And that's where enlightenment happens. It's not any place you need to go to, it's just already here in the present moment. You just have to be still enough for the mind to open up. Yeah, so this enlightenment is all, each and every one of us, deep in our mind. And we just have to be still. And then the flower of enlightenment starts to open up. Gradually, slowly, gradually. Yeah. Questions or comments? Yes? That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that's the Ananda method is very popular with monks as well. I'm just going to fall asleep and hopefully enlightenment happens before my head hits the pillow. Many monks have tried that. Yes, I could walk for another hour, but now I just go lie down and see what happens. Dear Bhante, what does samadhi mean? How can we get to samadhi? What it looks like? Right, samadhi is different translation. It's a Pali word for concentration, but I think Ajahn Brahm's latest translation I call it like stillness. What's that samadhi? It's just stillness. Nothing's happening. So yeah. So how do you get to it? By not doing anything, by accepting, by receiving, by surrendering yourself to whatever's happening, by making peace. That's how you get to stillness. You don't get to stillness by doing more things. That's just more doing. Get to stillness by being still. And what does it look like? It's a state of mind. So once you touch it, you will know. It's very distinct. Very distinct from agitated mind. And it's very pleasant also. So that's why you know that you're getting closer. When things are getting, more comfortable, more enjoyable. Feel more at ease in your mind, in the body as well. And there's many levels of stillness. Obviously, the stillness of the body, we have to tranquilize the body, make it comfortable first, settle that, and then the mind will start to go slowly. And it's a gradual, organic process, not something we can push. Not something we can control. But it's actually the opposite. So letting go. It's like a good simile that Ajahn Chah uses. It's like the leaf on the tree. It flutters because there's wind. And no matter how tight you hold that, it's always amount of trembling because of your muscles in your hand. So the leaf, no matter how hard or gentle you hold it, or how skillful you hold it, always a slight trembling. The only way that you can, the only way the leaf can stay still, perfectly still, is for you to let it go and for the wind to die down. The, you know, if there's wind, the wind's the one thing in our mind, the mind will move. We have any desire, craving, not subtle that big, it will move. The only thing that mind will stay still, when we don't have any more desire, we don't want anything. We're just perfectly content in the present moment. The mind stays still. See that? Samadhi. Questions? Comments? I think we're going to need a 10-day retreat to answer other questions. Having very vivid, complicated, and scary dreams at night and in my daytime naps. Is this something you have experienced? Every so often, but not very frequently. And usually, if you have some mindfulness in the dream, and you do have, you know, a scary dream or a scary situation, anxious situation, I just try to rouse up the feeling of metta, you know, of kindness, whatever is that threatening me or whatever scary monster you're looking at. May you be well and happy. And I think if you do have scary dreams, the practice of metta meditation, of kindness, of friendliness, is a great antidote to that. And that's one of the results of regularly practicing metta meditation. So you sleep very easily, you sleep very soundly, and you have very nice dreams. You don't have scary dreams. Yeah. That's one of the 8 or 10 benefits of metta meditation. And the creatures in the forest find you lovable. They're not threatened by you. You walk by and they stay, they don't rush away. Yeah, and then obviously the dangerous creatures don't harm you. Yeah. That's our kind of the good antidote to having nightmares. Or you have insomnia, you find it hard to get to sleep. Do 5 or 10 minutes of metta meditation before you fall asleep. It's also a very good one. Yeah. Very soothing. Do you want to take one? For you anyway. It's for you, right?
Can you tell us about what the season leading, what? Not reason leading, but to become a monk when you feel young. Great time. Then I needed to experience some suffering in my life, so that's why I decided to become a monk. Yeah, the reason why I became a monk is because I started meditating when I was a young lad, at 23 years old. So then at that time I had plenty of time, so I decided that maybe I should go to the monastery. So then I sort of quit my work, and then because I was living in Perth, luckily there's a monastery in Perth, and the teacher there is Ajahn Brahm, who probably many of you people know. So then I went there when I was 23. And Because you really want to get on to practice. So I spend a lot of time practicing my meditation. And because of the teachings that I was receiving and the environment that I was in, my meditation sort of got better. So then I decided I might as well just hang in there and ordain. So yeah, that's the reason why I'm still here.
Questions or comments?
Questions or comments?
Thank you for that. Okay, there's two questions here. Okay, one is, can you talk about addiction? Usually we think of addiction applies only to addicts, to drugs or alcohol uses. But addiction applies to nearly most of us. Most of us are addicted to something. Coffee, TV, computer, games, work, business, newspaper, chocolate, rebirth principles of dependent origination can help to become reborn in this life as a non-addict, free from drugs, coffee or chocolate. Can you talk about this process? We are addicts to a certain extent. We're addicted to sense pleasure, to having experience in things, to hearing, tasting, touching, and hearing, and also to the mind sense of remembering, talking, commenting to ourselves. You can see that it's very hard for us to not to be engaged in this one, you know, in this sixth sense world and some level. So we are, and that's what one of the Thai teachers, when he went to the US, that's what he says, these people are drunk, completely drunk on sense pleasure, always wanting, craving the next thing, a new movie, a dinner, a snack, you know, doing things, experience, new experience. And we are, so in that sense, we are addicts. And it's and also with anything is condition. It's because we've been conditioned to say that this is where happiness lies. That, you know, to get this hit, constantly looking for the next hit. We have to be doing something. You know, we're sitting with call our friends and have a chat, talking. So in that sense, yes, we are, and that's why we get reborn. We want to come back and do the whole thing over and over again. But I think with meditation, we've learned to kind of restrain that. And that's why restraint is important. Restraint is not a very popular word in our culture. It also usually is identified with suppression. You don't express yourself. And then you're suppressing and you're repressing something. But I think Buddhism, there is a middle way of, you know, knowing that you want this. Or you want to say something. But say, no, okay, this is not the right time. I'm not going to say that. So you're fully acknowledging that you have these urges, but you're also saying, you know, it's not healthy to always express these things, especially if it's unwholesome, if you want to hurt somebody, or if you want to harm, and also hurt or harm myself. I'm not going to, you know, take drugs. It might be good for an hour or two, but you know there's a hangover afterward, and it causes problems. So I think, you know, in terms of addiction, sense, we're caught up in it. And the thing is, it's because we find happiness. It's the only happiness we know through the five sense world. So once we learn to meditate, we find that there is a higher happiness in the sixth sense world, in the mind, in stillness, in peace. Then the mind, only then will the mind start to incline towards it. And that's why it's a gradual. That's why in the beginning, meditation is a bit of a chore. Because you step to kind of, you still have this craving for the five sense world, but you have to say no to a little bit. And say, okay, I'm going to go to a quiet place. I'm going to sit down and close my eyes and shut off the sense world. And in the beginning, it's kind of anti-intuitive. It doesn't feel very comfortable. But in the beginning, after a while, that's why you need some faith that this is worth, this is worthwhile. But after a while, when you realize that, you know, you experience some peace, just being in a quiet place, you're just like, oh, well, feel away from the shopping mall, away from the movie theater, away from all those kind of parties and celebrations. Oh, this is kind of kind of nice, actually. Find a quiet place in the bush, really nice. Then the mind will start to incline that automatically. But in the beginning, yeah, because we are addicts to sense world, it's difficult. So that's why, so that's my take on addiction and kind of how we can remove away or reverse the process of addicting to sense pleasures. Yeah. Is it clear? Is there any questions or comments?
If you keep the monastery away from connection with the mobile, from setting a satellite
up,
mobile?
I think we're naturally. I think there's no reception here.
Yeah.
Unless, I think they're getting better with new technology, next generation. Some people are getting in, and. But I think generally, yeah, we encourage people when they do come here to use their mobiles only for alarm clocks. And especially when the housing accommodation is down there. In the village, there's no accommodation and there's no reception. But in the higher hills, they are. And I think I will, I will try to keep it that way. Yeah, encourage people to kind of, really, there's no use going to the bush. You're going to bring your whole world with you through, your laptop and your internet. And your mobile phone, kind of defeating the purpose. Yeah. But also, we don't want to be draconian about. Sometimes people do need to make a quick phone call to check on things. But generally, we encourage people to kind of settle your affairs. Really, practice renunciation. Just you might think the world would fall apart. My family is gonna fall apart if I leave them alone. They're actually quite adaptable. That's question number one. Number two, can you become attached or even addicted to meditation and especially to bliss states? Calm, peaceful and happy states will be gone when something is not paid, while we neglect our duties. Will be gone when something is not paid while we neglect our duties. I think you can be attached to the blissful states that come up in meditation in the mind, but I think Ajahn Brahm said, there are much worse things to be addicted to be attached to. And with meditation, like I said, it's a progressive thing. So once your mind is clear, you see things clearly. So you see things clearly, that you know where you're going wrong. And the bliss of meditation only inclines a wholesome state, something that only reinforces your direction towards more peace and more clarity. So I think, and also for most of us, our minds are so complicated and so kind of, distracted, that the danger of being attached to meditation is very, very small. That way. unless you guys are essentially different from the regular meditators. And so it's not a bad thing to actually be addicted to meditating. Because I mean, if you're sitting watching your breath, there's not a whole lot of mischief that you can be doing. You can't break the first precept. You can't break the fourth precept. You can't get into drugs, alcohol. So it's not. It can be much worse, I think. Yes? Any questions or comments, clarifications? Powering through. Many new parents tell me how fulfilled they feel to have children and that their child's birth was the happiest moment of their lives. Also, they say that they discover love within them that they never knew they had. I do not have children and sometimes wonder if I have missed out. How do you feel about the prospect of not becoming a father? Quite good. It's great. I love being an uncle though. You play with all the kids and then okay, back you go. So my brother and my sister have kids and they grow up always, a big extended family. Like I said, it's interesting growing up in an Asian family. You know, some people say, you know, Asians have extended family, but it's not true. I think the reverse is true. The Westerners have contracted family. You get this kind of nuclear family only, you know, in the family. When Asia is like, you know, lots of cousins always around, and lots of aunts and uncles. I didn't really feel missing out, because with any kind of big reunion, you've got lots of kids running around all the time. So I certainly feel and don't feel like I'm missing out with the family in that way. And in terms of you know, having children, they have this moment. I think, yeah, it depends. I mean, some people do say, and also with kids, it does. They do stretch your tolerance, and you certainly learn to be more patient, actually, and it makes people grow up sometimes. And also, I think I've seen the parents that you know have little kids, and it's true. I do kind of appreciate, you know, amazing tolerance and amazing patience when dealing with little kids. I mean, you know, my sister, remember, was just had a baby a few years ago, and yeah, it was just like, you know, got to wake up every few hours just to feed the kid. Oh, and that happens, you know, for a year or two or something, she said, and just wake up tired all the time. Yes, maybe 20 years. Yeah, and then so it stretches that way. It stretches, you know, your tolerance. And actually, you know, it can be a bad thing. Other times, otherwise, we grew up in a culture, it's always me, about me and myself. And having to take care of another being, helpless being, it's a good, certainly a good practice. But I think, having said that, there are more researches out, and actually coming, that's the opposite, actually. They interview all these thousands of applications, you know, happiest moments of your life, and kind of this kind of graph. And they said, actually, just the opposite. That says that couples are the happiest before the firstborn, and it kind of tails down until the kids are grown up, and then it sparks up again. So now there's the research that actually says the opposite is true, that raising a family is quite taxing on the level of happiness that people feel, and that for each other. And that actually when the kids are growing up, and outside of that, that is actually, wow, we have more time. We actually can get to know each other again and be with each other. So that's also interesting. That I think the latest book I saw a few years ago in Perth was, I think, Stumbling on Happiness, where he does all this kind of research, what, you know, people consider to be happy, and, you know, different quotients that they set their happiness standards for. So that's an interesting thing. Any questions or comments? Occasionally when I'm meditating, sometimes when I'm not, a thick cloud of sadness and shame descends on me. It seems impenetrable. How can I handle this? Thank you. I think with sadness or shame or dark spots in our mind, or meditating or not, I think with anything, it's just to kind of to learn to hold it, to learn to embrace it, and also to see. Sometimes we don't see when it's with us, but to see when it passes, that these things come and go according to their own causes and conditions, according to their own game plan. And when we have the mindfulness, maybe just like you said, you just kind of notice, you know, when does this mood pass you or come into contact with, how many hours, how many days, and just to notice. And once you see that one, you pass through this dark mood, you know that they're gone, and just remember, okay, I was really depressed, but now it's gone. So it's just going to bring up as much mindfulness as you can, you know, before the mood happens, while the mood is happening, and afterwards. Just reflect during the whole time that these things come and they go, and we are not in control. We like to think we are, but that's part of the delusion. So by accepting and by also just to study them, to feel what's it like to have this dark mood, to look at it from an objective angle. Not as your bad mood, but it's just a mood, a dark mood that comes. It has nothing to do with you really. And that's also a mind, it's just a mind, condition. that we have some control, but no, not anywhere near as much as we think we have control over our mind. So with the body it gets sick, the mind is the same. Sometimes we have this delusion that we can control our mind, that we should be always be happy. And that's not entirely true. But we do get dark spots, and you know, no one's immune to this. Not even monks. Unless you're enlightened, you're gonna have these dark spots. And the trick is, you know, for myself anyway, it's just you're gonna be with it. You know that you have a bad mood. But you also know that it ends with anything. And just to kind of hold it. Have as much mindfulness just to hold these things in the mind. Okay. Were there questions or comments? I think metta meditation helps. You know, it's just to have kindness toward yourself and have kindness towards other people. Why using the word timeless to talk about the Dhamma in chanting? Okay. Timeless, I think, akaliko, I think. It means that, you know, it is not bound to any time in the past or in the future, but it's always, you can apply the teaching of the Dhamma, you know, any time, anywhere. That's always true. Because we have a mind, works in a certain way, like the, you know, the force of gravity. Whether you see it or not see it, whether you believe in it, it still works. The sense of Dhamma, as long as you apply it, it's regardless. Some people say, well, you know, the Buddha was, you know, aligned him, but that's 2600 years ago. We're completely different environments, different culture. You know, he's Indian, I'm a Western person, woman, you know, kind of in this modern culture, you know, do I have this, what it takes to become enlightened? And I would say, yes, yeah. You know, what we think we are, you know, we still have the basic five khandhas, like I was talking about yesterday. We have a body, we have a mind, we have, you know, perceptions, feeling, consciousness. And that's what all it takes. As long as, you know, we kind of direct our attention towards the right way, gradually moving towards the wholesome, away from the unwholesome habits. So that's why the Dhamma is timeless, because you can apply it at any time. Bhante, can you describe your experience of Thai Forest Monastery? Describe a day, the people, the visitors, the environment, what you like and what you don't like. There's a whole book here I can write. Describe difficulties you've had. And by the way, is this true that when you monks get sick, the medicine given to them is in some of the older monastery is fermented urine of the old abbot? No, that's not true. It's not fermented urine of the old abbot. It's your own fermented urine. We do. It's a folklore, but it's true. When I was in Thailand 10 years, you didn't have so much, malaria prophylactic. So one of the things they did recommend was to drink your own urine. And it's not that bad, really. You drink lots of water. It's okay. The only problem was, you know, is you have 20 rooms full of people and everybody's on this urine therapy. Now it's like a toilet. So that was very good, but otherwise, it's not a major problem. I think there's a few books I can recommend. I think one was put together by Wapananachat. They call it The Forest Path, and they published an account. They have different monks write, you know, accounts of their experience living in a monastery, and they got it together and they published a book called Forest Path. So if you Google that, it should be on the internet somewhere. And I think a few books have come out. I think a Thai lady named Kamala wrote a book, Buddha in the Forest, that also describes life of a forest monk and what the practice they do. And I think Forest Recollections is also another book. So there's a few books that tell us about the life of forced monks and nuns in Thailand at the time. Yeah. Okay, dear Bhante, I often heard the phrase meaning of life, but I'm afraid to admit I don't know what the meaning of life is. Perhaps laugh consciously. Could you please talk a little bit on what this phrase means within a Buddhist context? What has been recommended for a lay Buddhist and what might be the reasons for such recommendation? Thank you so much for your joyful presence and for sharing with us your totally awesome wisdom. Okay, wow. The meaning of life is actually for each and every one of us to discover for ourselves, actually. Yeah. And I think, you know, and it has different contexts and it depends on different people. And I think that's ultimately for each and every one of us. You know, what is the meaning of life for me? For us to reflect every day. What makes, you know, what makes us happy, or what am I here for? One of the ways to look at life is, you know, we're here to learn a lesson. And because we haven't learned it, we keep coming back. But also, what does it mean? When we have a difficult situation, there's also a lesson to be learned here. So what does that mean? You know, what meaning can we get from this? How can we make sense of the world? I think the meaning of life is to learn what is the true meaning of happiness. What is true happiness? Once we learn that, then we know what life is about. What is happiness and what is suffering? True happiness and true suffering. Where does that lay? Where can we find it? And that's what we learn through internal reflection. It's what hopefully we investigate when we have a peaceful mind. A good meditation, you say, yeah, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? Because sometimes, you know, in this world of ours, we get carried away with you know, having things, doing things, that we lost track of, you know, what's the meaning? Am I here just to, you know, do a few things, go to a few movies, have a few friends, and then grow old and die? Yeah, what is it? That's a good reflection, it's a good koan for each and every one of us to kind of to study. As a lay Buddhist, I think I would recommend, you know, living wholesome lives, obviously keeping the five precepts, practicing as much meditation as you can, but also practice generosity, you know, within your family context to the people around you, you know, and be good sons and daughters, have gratitude towards your parents. If you're a parent, then you know, be a good parent. Live a wholesome life, a life that you can look back and be proud of, that you didn't hurt anybody, that you work for the welfare and happiness of the people around you, but also making yourself happy in the whole process. What is deep contentment? Any questions or comments? Clarifications? Venerable Anand writes that metta and concentration develop together. Would you like to expand on his words? Oh, to expand on a word of a highly attained monk. I don't know, it's quite tricky. I think Ajahn Anand, who is well known for his metta, who is well known for metta meditation, just radiates this sense of joy and this kind of, like I said, when you're with him, you know that he's totally there for you. And he has your interest in mind. Whatever he says is, you know, it's very gentle, pleasing to the ear, and it's beneficial for your practice. It's his way of carrying around. And so he makes his practice, and you can see that his monastery is huge, and there's tons and tons of people just showing up, wanting to be in his presence and ask for his advice on different things. That's just one of the byproducts of having kind of unbounded metta. Like, lots of people want to be around you. And like I said, he has a whole entourage of monks, who, you know, five or six of them, who are just going to hang around him all day long, just to be around him. So, and that's one of the byproducts of having unbounded metta. And he said, when you do have metta, just kind of naturally embracing, accepting presence, and accepting mind, so it's very easy to become concentrated. It is the fault-finding mind that we have that looks around, that doesn't allow us to become still. So we do have a messed mind of loving kindness, of friendliness, that greatly enhances our meditation naturally. Because it doesn't look for other things, it appreciates what you already have. And that's the ultimate meaning of stillness. You're not moving around. You're there. Appreciate what you have is the only way you can stay in the present moment. Embracing, accepting, receiving. A nice word somebody told me the other day. Just receive whatever nature's offered, the universe has offered you this precious moment. And our job is just receive it as gentle as we can, with harmlessness and appreciation. That when there's no movement, no wanting that we don't have, no pushing away what we have. Yeah. I know a question. Everybody's falling asleep. Okay. What is your position on lay Buddhist teachers and scholars? Thai Theravada Buddhism is regarded as the most conservative and fundamental of all traditions. Very true. And yes, it is Theravada tradition which has been successfully adopted in its non-religious form in the West and is taught to the thousands of big courses in Spirit Rock IMS or Gaia House, something reduction clinic of Harvard University, Stress Reduction Clinic of Harvard University. There's a huge and growing group of excellent lay meditation teachers and scholars. What is your position on lay teachers? And what's your position on Western Buddhism? Yes, I have to admit, we are definitely fundamentalist. And the emphasis is on fun. Well, good times of mind. Because it's the path is about meditation. Once you get your meditation down, things become naturally bright and beautiful and easy to live. And so we're very fundamentalist. But to get back to the question of the conservative, it's true. It's also because the Thai, the Theravada, it's by its nature conservative, because Theravada means the vehicles of the elders. And it's meant to conserve a way of life and a way of teaching, we think, closest to what the Buddha taught. We rely on the Pali suttas, Pali discourses that the Buddha taught when he was around. And we try to stick to that. And also in terms of lifestyle, we try to live in the life of the monks and nuns in the forest, of simplicity and renunciation. Trying to not to get involved in too many extracurricular activities outside the monastery. Mostly when we do teach, it's mostly about meditation and about and teaching the Dhamma. And I think the reason why it's been very successful in transplanting to the West is because, especially from Ajahn Chah, he has a very direct way of communicating the Dhamma, very practical way. I always want to bring the Dhamma to allow the people to practice in the daily life, how to alleviate suffering, how to find more happiness and contentment in their lives, and in a way that people can connect with, in a way that people can use the teaching. There's many some scholars in our tradition, we try to refrain from using very technical languages that make people feel uncomfortable. So we try to kind of reduce the teaching to much more practical, and also the teaching of meditation, which is the main focus of most Thai first tradition. And I feel meditation has a great effect in the West, mental health, because in the last 30 years we're getting very good in terms of knowing what to take care of our body, healthy diet and exercise and yoga and all sorts of things to make our body very healthy. But we're only beginning to have a feel for what makes a healthy mind. where that lays, what kind of suffering we create for ourselves, and where's the happiness. And meditation, that's where meditation is great. It's 2,600 years of experience behind us. It's well-trodden path. Very clear instructions from the Buddha, from his disciples, what you need to do to be happy, to be content, to have a bright and clear mind. So that's where we're miles ahead of psychotherapy, of kind of, you know, that can reinforce it. But, you know, and also in psychology. And one of the missteps, I think, this is my personal opinion, is that Western psychology was, you know, done by Freud, who studied the psychosis of the mind. What makes the mind depressed? He didn't study what makes the mind happy. It's only recently the research has gone into, you know, what is a happy mind? You know, what is a contented mind? What's a bright mind? We've gone to start out with looking at what makes a sick mind. So that's not entirely helpful. But only recently you can see, and with Buddhism, it's always, you know, about how to live, you know, in harmony within yourself and the people around you. And to, that, to know that, you know, that the external circumstances, how we live our life outside, affects us inside, and vice versa. Unless you're happy and content, and a balanced individual, you're not going to be able to radiate that care, the compassion that you like to radiate. If we're depressed, we're not going to be any use to other people. No matter how much we want to help other people, it's not going to, you know, we're not going to have the clarity of mind to do anything. And that's what Buddhism, you know, helps us. But just the fact that we're sitting here, and it seems like a self-indulgent act to go on a meditation, to focus inward. But the irony of the whole thing, and you can see for yourself, is that when you're settled, when you're grounded, you can be such a great benefit to your family and your friends and people that you live with, and the people around us, than any kind of social activity. So, you know, the division between what you do for yourself and to help the society around us is not so clear cut. It's not always the case of, you know, for me only or for the other people only. It's actually by helping ourselves, we're helping society be much more peaceful, caring, sensitive. Once we, you know, like I said, once we resolve our own internal issues, then we can be really there to care, to interact with the people around us in a very healthy, beneficial way. Instead of from dependency, from habitual tendency, from aversions, from guilt, we can truly help the world around us. So that's why I think meditation and the Thai Four tradition is important in the West, because it brings the teachings and kind of, you know, available to people. Yeah, does it make sense? Any questions, clarifications yet, Kumar? Yeah. Yes, good thing it only came at the end. Otherwise, we won't start talking about this. But there's been a few emails devoted to this, flying around the internet if you're in that kind of niche. And yeah, it was quite controversial. Ajahn Brahm, my teacher, ordained 4 10 precept nuns to be fully ordained bhikkhunis. And it was controversial only because in Thailand it's not recognized. And I think while and also it's controversial because also Ajahn Brahm kept it a secret from his colleagues, the other Western monks, and as well as the head monk of his tradition in Thailand. So I think Jinya-wise, obviously there are bhikkhunis because he ordained them in accordance to the rules that put on by the Buddha. But in terms of, you know, acceptance from the larger sangha, because he didn't consult his elders, and it's, you know, it's kind of a bit of a tragedy, because it was the thing that the meeting, there was this large meeting of different abbots. They're going to decide or how to proceed with the bhikkhu ordination or have a view on it. And unfortunately, Ajahn Brahm jumped the gun by ordaining before the meeting took place. So he did it unilaterally. And the problem with that is, part of a tradition is we like to have consensus, we like to have agreement, and by kind of trumping the card, there is some ill feeling, obviously, from the other monasteries, that he was not working with them. So it's still an ongoing thing. And I think, you know, in terms of, you know, ordination, full ordination for women in the Theravada tradition, I think what happened over time, because there's more and more women who are ordaining already and practicing. So over time it will kind of happen. But the course of that, it's, you know, the next 15, 20 years we'll see. And I think, you know, even in Australia, especially Australia, is quite in the forefront of this. There's obviously a monastery in Perth where Ajahn Brahm set up a monastery in Dhammasara for nuns to practice. And in Victoria as well, there's also a bhikkhuni monastery for ladies to practice. Yeah, in the Thai, well, it's not Thai force tradition, but in the Theravada tradition anyway. Yeah, it's a Sri Lankan, but ladies, she's Swiss. Yeah, but the Buddhist Society of Victoria, they are sponsoring a nunnery. Yeah, so there's soon as opportunity, lots of opportunities for ladies to practice. Whether you have to be fully ordained nun to practice, that's you know, obviously a controversial question, because in the Amawati, in English Sangha, they have a ordination, but they follow a new order where they follow about 100. They went through the rules, and a lot of the rules of the Buddhist nuns are kind of archaic, just like the monks. That doesn't really, you know, like where, how to build a house or how to build a hut and to travel in horse carts and different things that really don't really apply. So they kind of left all that behind and just picked out about 150 rules that really apply to train the mind and you know, for the welfare of the Sangha and stuff like that. So they have their own kind of new order of bhikkhuni. They don't call themselves bhikkhuni, they call themselves the Siladharas, but also kind of a nun. And they've been practicing in that monastery, in that kind of community for 25 years. And so they are, it seems to work well enough for them. So that's where, you know, Lupo Samedo is supporting. He's supporting the 10 priests and nuns that are practicing in the community, because it doesn't offend the kind of Thai headquarters. But also it's kind of the middle way where the nuns, you know, still run their own monastery, can still practice, but it doesn't go against the grain of saying, you know, that ordaining is something new. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think. Yeah, no, I think going forward, that's why Lupo Samedo actually came up with a new system of the nuns, because the nuns certainly are not they run their own affairs, they have a nunnery and they determine what happens there, and also their teachings, they're, you know, teachers in their own right. So the nuns of Amaravati. I think the question is going forward regarding the bhikkhunis, whether it's whether lost my train of thought. I think this is the interruption. Was that in terms of, you said, you know, when Buddhism spread to India, Sri Lanka, and different places, it adopted local culture. But that's not entirely true. The reason I feel that the fourth tradition actually is so successful in the West is that it hasn't been to the different rules and regulations of the West. Like, you know, like when first the Portomato went to England, they said, "Nah, you can't go on Armstrong. You cannot use money, because one of the rules that we keep is that we don't use any money." They said, "No, that's not going to work. You've got to have money, and you've got to start driving around, because no one's going to drive you around." But Lumpur Samhita, with Ajahn Chah's, you know, kind of encouragement, stuck to all the rules we kept, all the Vinaya rules, in the tradition of Thailand. And you know, we don't cook our own food, which was, and the Vinaya says, "No, you start. You know, no one's going to come. Westerners aren't Buddhists. They're not going to come and feed you. You must be crazy." But, you know, they had faith and said, "No, no, you know, we follow the rules. You know, I think, you know, the Buddha will take care of us. You know, the spiritual perfections of the Buddha, you know, or the people who knows what the religion can appreciate, they will kind of come." And actually, over the years, the communities and the monasteries in the West actually support the monks keeping the traditional rules and regulations of the discipline. That, you know, not really coming into contact with women, you know, not being alone, all that's very, instead of saying, "Oh, you know, this is co-ed, you know, don't be so kind of touchy, don't be a bit backward, you know, men and women are the same." But I think we still recognize that there is, you know, inherent capacity for both men and women to be enlightened, but it's more of a separation. We're still back in the you know, single-sex community. It's the best way to work towards enlightenment, that, you know, there's monk's place and then there's a nun's place. And everybody keeps to that kind of model to work for. So I think so that's not so much a question of the kind of opportunities for women to ordain. There are opportunities for women to ordain and to live in monasteries in the West, in the Thai Theravada tradition. But and like obviously Amawati, you have, you know, the nuns there, and also Chidhurst. But to whether we can revive the ancient form of a bhikkhuni. You know, the Thais only thing is that it takes another Buddha to revive it. But and also, I don't know whether it's actually necessary. The monks and the nuns and Amawati seem to be doing a fine job. We had Sister Chandasuri here a few weeks, you know, last month, teaching a retreat with myself. And they seem to be, you know, doing pretty good on their own. It's moving forward with their community. He's relying, but in a way that not to contradict them, because he knows at the time. Yeah. No. Yeah, there's plenty of things being said. That's right, that's right. That's right. Thank you. right. Yeah, I think also, I mean, it is a fair point. It is, you know, Theravada it is a very, you know, by and large, a boys club until recently. And but like I said, with anything, there is changes coming. And like I said, in the West, in Amawati and Chithurst, there are communities of nuns practicing in their respective monasteries. But I think going forward, what I understand from the meeting is that, yeah, I think the monks and also the nuns feel that going forward, it's probably better for each community to start developing on their own. And you won't have just dual communities, but you have, you know, a monastery in one place, and then, you know, maybe a different place, you have a nunnery. That way there's, you know, there's less friction, and people can develop, you know, their own place according to their own needs. Yeah, and I think there's lots and lots of support for the ladies' places, nunneries in different places. Because, you know, people do recognize that it's good to have places where the woman can practice, and also to have teachers that can teach from a feminine perspective. That's right. Yes? Okay, good. Any additional comments, questions? Good. Thank you all the questions and contributions.